This episode is sponsored by BeaverFit. And as always, this is another company that I've not only been aware of for several years, but I also completely trust and I know is a great fit for this audience. Having not only been a firefighter in my career, but also a strength and conditioning coach, I've seen the challenges that we have getting the tactical athlete fit when it comes to budgets, when it comes to space. And BeaverFit has solutions for so many of our challenges. When it comes to space, they have the gym box, for example, which is literally the size of a footlocker that when you open it up and build it, becomes a squat rack, a pull-up bar, a box, and even a wall ball target. So you can get a full workout for a crew purely on that one box. Expanding out, they have storage containers that become entire gyms. You store everything in the inside, and you can then deploy racks and pull-up bars on the outside. They have gyms on trailers you can take from station to station. They have tactical boxes with breaching props and collapse props. And then on the flip side, the durability is another issue that we see. So often departments buy the low bid, you know, the cheapest they can find. And ultimately that hard-earned wellness budget gets wasted in equipment that rusts and falls apart. BeaverFit's gear is designed to be used in the most extreme environments, whether it's the deserts of the Middle East or simply on the deck of a naval ship. So they are designed to not only be outside, but to be beaten up by some of the most elite operators on the planet. If you want to hear more about this company, and I'm sure you do, listen to episode 477 with the original founder, Tom Beaver from the UK, or the founders of BeaverFit USA, Alex Rudehouse and Mike Taylor, on episode 457. Or visit BeaverFit USA and click on the Military and Tactical tab. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show medium Jonathan Mark. Now, in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from Jonathan's family becoming aware that he had a special set of skills, his journey into NYPD, how he ultimately began helping law enforcement as a medium, some notable cases he's worked on, finding closure for families, mental health, dating, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,000 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Jonathan Mark. Enjoy. Well, Jonathan, I want to say two things to start. Firstly, thank you so much to Kate Casey, our mutual friend, for making the connection. And secondly, to welcome you onto the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you, Kate Casey. You're the best.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
I'm on Long Island. My whole family's from Long Island. I grew up on Long Island. I travel like around, obviously, to a few places, but my home base, I always tell people, is New York, Long Island.
Well, speaking of growing up there, then I'd love to start at the very beginning. So tell me about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
I have one brother. He works in iCloud tech software. So he does like the sales for a major company. And my mom is in HR for a bank, and my dad is a financial advisor.
Brilliant. So then, with that kind of family dynamic, I'm assuming your parents were home every night, so it wasn't like some of these people I have on the show where they have military parents or first responder parents. What was the kind of dynamic growing up? Were you a latchkey kid, or was there more of a kind of traditional nuclear family element?
I would probably say it was more like my parents worked full-time for like 12 hours a day, so my grandmother would watch us, so my grandma would like basically raise us from when we were young kids until we were in high school. And my parents would try to make life as normal as possible while working very tough jobs. But it was a pretty normal childhood, honestly. And I'm very blessed to say that.
What about sports? What were you playing during the school age?
Oh my God. I mean, anything really. But I started to gravitate as I was older towards wrestling and lacrosse.
It's always interesting when you have someone who plays a team sport, and then obviously there's one that's more of an individual element like wrestling. So as you progress through it, I mean, obviously we'll talk about your time in law enforcement, you know, initially going through academy and training, but which elements of the individual sports factored into that, and then which elements of the team sports?
You know, that's a good question. I think the individual side is, I was learning at a young age from wrestling, from like middle school to high school and all that, that, you know, I can either succeed by myself or lose on myself, like by myself. And I can't blame the people around me. Like, it's all on me. And it taught me a lot from, like, I think in a couple different ways in like life, and obviously the sport of wrestling too. I think in life, it just taught me that as much effort as you put in, you'll kind of see the success, and you can't blame anyone if you mess up. And like, I think growing up, sometimes when I was watching my friends play like baseball, basketball, or whatever, like a team sport, but really before like lacrosse became like my major sport, I noticed that, you know, they would be like, oh, Jimmy did this and that's why we lost, or Jimmy like screwed up this play and this is why we lost. And I think going in, you know, through the process and the academy and all of that, you know, you have to heavily rely on the people around you. And lacrosse gave me that like brotherhood, which is like something that I love. Like, I love the brotherhood. I love, like, we go through hell together on the field in practice. We win together, we lose together. And you'll protect the person to the left, to the right, in front, or behind you. And that like made me gravitate more towards a team sport than an individualistic sport of like a wrestling, because I wanted that team feeling, which translated into the academy and everything.
What is the contact level in lacrosse? We and I was in school, which was a long time ago. We actually had a Canadian come to England and we did lacrosse for a semester, but we just had the sticks and the ball. We didn't have any of the helmets and pads. And randomly, there was one of the kids in my school that could play lacrosse. I don't know how the hell he found a school there. But it seems like, you know, obviously it's kind of almost like a land version of ice hockey. But what is the contact level versus, for example, a sport like football?
It's pretty full contact. I mean, like, you obviously can't like tackle someone and wrap your arms around them and bring them to the ground. But a lot of the times, like, you can run and just like hit someone pretty hard, like with your shoulder. Rules have changed since I played in college till now, because they're trying to be a little bit more protective of like the CTE like stuff. So when I was in college and playing, like, people were like running like at you like head first to like make direct contact with you. And then with the stick too, on top of that, they'll be able to slash you, like hit you with the stick in your elbow, your arm, you know, try to, you know, strip you or like get the stick out of your hand and everything. So it's pretty full contact. The only difference I will make with that towards like American football and lacrosse is it's such a like a fast sport. There's no stop, go, stop, go, stop, go. It's a constant. So like, if you get hit, the game still goes. Like, it's not like one of those where like in football, if you have the ball and you get hit and you're sacked, the play's over. So I think it's pretty full contact. It gets pretty chippy out there.
I played field hockey when I was in school. Football was, you know, obviously very, very popular, and I loved playing it, but I wasn't good enough to really play on the team. I didn't really have the drive to play on the team, but field hockey was always seen as a bit of a girl sport. But men's field hockey, just as you said, you've got a stick and you've got a ball that is rock solid and no pads or anything. And I don't think, you know, people realize how freaking aggressive that sport is until you actually get on the field and play it.
I can imagine. I would just imagine that people just like slashing at like your shins, your ankles, or, you know, trying to go after the ball and boxing people out. It would have to be, I would assume, like, so aggressive. But you are right, because a lot of people, you know, even Kay Casey played field hockey in college too. So it's like she would tell me it would get very chippy there, like very, very chippy, because we share stories about that like all the time. So I would assume that it would get pretty chippy.
Absolutely. Well, what about career aspirations when you were in the school age? What were you dreaming of becoming?
You know, it's interesting. When I was a kid and when I was in high school, I always wanted to help people. That was something that was like a huge driving force for me in the beginning of choosing colleges and deciding what I wanted to do in life. For a long time, I wanted to be military. That was something I wanted very badly, to either join the Marines, the Army, the Navy, anything. And as I got a little bit older, like with the college recruiting process, I was getting recruited to, you know, West Point, Annapolis, and all that. And I saw what these men were, and I was in awe of them. And I got in this in my mind a little bit, where I was like, I don't think I can compare to these people. Like, I just can't. Like, they're like, I was going through these visits, and I'll never forget, like, when I went to Annapolis, and we were just talking about the career trajectory of, like, when you graduate the Naval Academy, or like, they were telling me I have to go to prep school in Rhode Island before I can go to Annapolis, but I would commit to Annapolis. And then if I wanted to make a career, you know, and like every young kid, and I'm not going to lie, every young kid's like Navy SEAL, Green Beret, right? Like, you're like, that's what I want. And they told me, they're like, all right, you go to Lake Erie, or, and then you go to Coronado Island. So I went to Coronado to just check it out. And I'll never forget, like, I was with my mom. So it was like kind of nuts. I was with my mom, and we go on, and I guess a class just finished Hell Week or something. Like, it was like they just finished Hell Week, it seemed. And they were ramped up, like amped up. And like, and I was just like, these are like men. Like these are men. I'm like, I feel like a child next to them. I'm like, these are men. So I was like, once, and like other medical stuff happened to me also too, with like things I couldn't control with, if I wanted to dive, my eardrums were not great when I was a kid. I had surgery. So the high pressure, they said my eardrums would burst if I did any diving exercises, anything like past a certain amount of feet. Like, they were going through like my medical history with my family and myself. And I think that also scared me too, if I'm being honest. Like, they're like, this could happen and this can happen. And I was such an impressionable kid, and I came from not a bad area on Long Island. So I was like, I'm just going to go to college and get a sport management degree, because I was getting recruited. And, you know, I wanted to also have fun with my friends, but I also wanted to see what that life was about with the military. And then I kind of just graduated, and I went to Universal McCann, which is an advertising agency. But during that time, I took the police test. So when I took the police test, I heard back like 3-4 months later. So I had to go through the process as I just started the workforce. Like, it was like such a weird time for me, because I thought it was going to take years. Honestly, I did not think it was going to take like 4 months, 5 months.
When you said you had surgery on your eardrums, I had the grommets. I forget what they call them here, but the little kind of syringe piece that they put in when you have all the earwax and you can't swim for months at a time, which is when I learned how to play squash as a little boy. Was that what you had as well?
Yeah, I had tubes in my ear. I just remember being a kid, and I would be playing outside with my brother, and like this blue tube came out of my ear, and I was like, what is that? And my mom would like grab me and be like, that's good. That means blah, 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 blah. And I didn't really understand what it was. And it's interesting too, because anytime I go get like a physical or something with a doctor, they, you know how they put this stuff in your ear and they look at your eardrums. They're like, you have so much scar tissue on your eardrum from all this stuff. They're like, your eardrum looks so beat up for a 30-year-old, right? Like, they're like, that's crazy. So yeah, it was weird. I'm not going to lie.
Well, staying in your childhood, obviously we're going to walk through, you know, the realization or the confirmation of, you know, the sensitivities that you have, a lot of us don't. it seems apparent that we are extremely open when we're very young. So what were kind of your earliest memories when you reflect back now of maybe having some of these sensitivities and feelings and visions even that maybe some other children weren't having?
Yeah, so it kind of goes back to when I was about 4 years old. And I hear a lot of these stories, and I do remember some, but I really hear it from my family members because they were like, I'm not going to lie, they were weirded out. Like they just were, like, because they didn't really know what it was. So I just remember being, about 4 years old is when I, you know, I think first started talking about like things I was seeing, right? And, you know, the story I tell people because it's the first time my whole family heard it was it was like Easter Sunday or something. And my aunt Susan, she passed away when I was 6 months old. And long version short, my mom and her were best friends, lived together after college in Queens. And when she had cancer, she lived with my mom before she passed. And, you know, so I was 6 months old when she passed. And I went up to my grandfather, so my mom's and Susan's father. And I said, Susie's here. Aunt Susie's here. And I'm sure just like majority of people, including myself, I could probably, you know, I'm at my parents' house right now. I could probably lift up my laptop and show you pictures of people that had passed away in our family. Like people have pictures of, you know, family members, friends, people that were close to them. And my grandfather's like, oh, okay, cool. Like, you know, what's she doing? You know, just like being kind of like weirded out that I'm even saying it. And back in the day, my mom used to dress me as what I called a Canadian tuxedo, the denim top and denim shorts or whatever. So I kept saying that, you know, my aunt, like, I'm like, Susie's like wearing this. And I kept pulling at my shirt. And my grandfather's like, what the heck is this kid saying? And my mom's other sister was there and she was also confused. So my mom walks around the other room like she saw 12 ghosts and was like crying. And my grandfather's like, why, like what's going on? And my mom like explains it like this, where they had the service and everyone was going to their, well, everyone exited and went to their cars to go, you know, to the cemetery for the burial like portion. And while everyone was there, my mom walked, like stormed back in, and there was a jean jacket that they would steal from each other like all the time because they used to steal clothes from each other. But there was this one jean jacket, this denim jacket, and my mom buried it or put it in the coffin with her as like her own personal thing. She didn't want anyone to know. She just did not want anyone to know. It was like her thing with Susan, and she's like, that's what it is. So my mom starts crying, and my grandfather and everyone, I guess, looked at me and they're like, like, we didn't know this. How the heck did you know this? Like, so then, you know, as I was getting older, you know, I was seeing and like I was continuing to see Susan, my Aunt Sue, wearing different outfits, like describing what she was wearing, things that my mom would only know just because there weren't any pictures of her in those outfits or with the jewelry, et cetera. And I was seeing other people's family too, but I didn't really understand what it was because I thought it was normal what I was seeing. Like I thought everyone was seeing that. Like I just like, you know, kind of thought it was normal. But then when I was a teenager, I remember just being like, not everyone is seeing this or not everyone's feeling this. And I became a little bit of like an introvert because of that, because I just didn't know what was going on in my mind. Like I thought my mind was playing tricks on me. Like I didn't really know, you know, for a while.
What was the environment then? Obviously now, you know, as we're talking about it, there seems to be a lot more, you know, open conversation accepted. But when you were going through your teens, I mean, what, if you said the word medium, what would have been the reaction back then?
For one, I don't even think people would even know what that is my age. But I think if I was to explain it back then, they would have crucified me. Like they would have made fun of me. They would have thought I was crazy. Like, you know, I don't think it would have, it's way more acceptable today to talk about it. I don't think it was then, which is why I was like, I'm not going to share this with anyone. Like, I know people are going to make fun of me. I know that. Like, I know that's what's going to happen because my friends were like playing sports, like, you know, starting to, you know, drink, starting to hang out with girls. Like they, seeing dead people or speaking about that, they would be like, what is wrong with this kid? like who, and they would make fun of me, and I just didn't want that. So I became introverted, and I became, you know, kind of a little to myself, because I was battling, you know, what was going on, and I didn't know how to make sense of it.
When I did some research on you, it mentioned about 20 years old, you getting a confirmation. So what was that shift mm-hmm. around that age then?
Yeah, so I was going off to college to play lacrosse, and I was with, you know, my mom the night before, and I turned to her and I asked if there's any mental illness in the family, because I thought I was schizophrenic, because there was a period of time, probably from when I was like 12, 13 to when I went off to college, where I really didn't speak about this anymore because I was so afraid to talk about it. And so I asked my mom, and she goes, no. And I go, well, I'm still seeing things. And she goes, well, I'm going to see a medium. Do you want me to ask the medium? And I was like, I didn't know really what a medium was. And I was like, I guess. So the medium was like, he could be crazy. You have to bring him in. So when I came in, it was validated that I could do this. So it was kind of like a comfort for me to know that I wasn't crazy.
Did you ever find out what it was that medium saw or felt that confirmed you were a medium?
You know, I really don't know, like, fully. I think it was, I don't really know. I don't remember. Like, I would have to ask my mom, because my mom was with me through it. And I know this sounds silly. I'm like over 30, and like I still refer to my mom about this, but she's been such a crucial part in this, like telling me to pursue this, like helping me with this and all that. So I would have to ask her, because I don't remember, because it was so long ago.
So walk me through your journey into law enforcement, and then the interesting story that takes you right back out again.
Yeah. So I was working at Universal McCann, and I got, you know, I got the email. They're like, hey, your list number's up, you know, come to blah, blah, blah. You're going to start the process. So the process, I'm sure many people know, it's like, you know, paperwork, you meet your investigator, you do your agility test, and you do your psych test, and then it's the mini med. And once you pass all that stuff, then you get the email that you're joining the academy. And the academy would always run July, October, January, and April. And October and April were typically smaller classes for NYPD, mostly for people that just finished like military service or anything like that. Like they would put those people typically together most of the time. So I got the email, and, you know, there wasn't too many people in my family that were law enforcement. So I was one of the, you know, everyone was working finance, or they were lawyers or whatever. And I never saw myself doing that. I saw myself trying to give myself to help people. And so I went through the process, and, you know, I met the investigator. And when I was going through my interview with the investigator, you know, someone sat down with me and they're like, we hear you're a lacrosse player. They're like, do you know NYPD has a lacrosse team? You know, like all of that stuff. So as time went on, you know, my, like, you know, to backtrack a little bit, like after I got the confirmation and stuff about being a medium and not crazy, my mom was bringing friends of people that I didn't know. Like, just because if I know someone when I'm reading them, and I'm sure people can piece this together as well, it becomes memory based. It doesn't become authentic. Like the more you know about someone actually hurts the reading, in my opinion, like way more, because then you become biased, and then you know things, and it's like, you don't, it's not great. So because my mom was doing that, friend of a friend of a friend of a very high level ranking officer, and a couple of them saw my list number, saw all that stuff, my tax number, my tag number, all that stuff. And they pulled me aside and they said, listen, we want you to be able to go home. Like, that's something that's super important to us, and that we wish that we can tell more people to do, to like go home and be with your family and be safe. They're like, harness this gift, and when we seem it's fit, we'll use you as a resource. But you have a lot of work to do. So they're like, get on this work. And credit to my mom and my family to like stop all this. It was a hard thing to do, and it was a hard thing, I think, for me, and not to get like deep or anything, and I'm sure people don't like care or whatever, but I've been such a team player my whole life when it comes to lacrosse and everything, that to quit on a team or to quit on anyone was pretty hard for me, but I felt like it was the right decision to do. So that's kind of how like it all went through the process and got to like being like starting to be able to help the law enforcement, kind of, because then there's a whole other side to it.
With that conversation, one would assume that they'd had some sort of interaction with mediums or psychics in, you know, prior to that, and had seen the value. So did you ever learn about basically predecessors of the FBI, NYPD, whoever the kind of environment was?
I learned about it way later on. I don't think I knew about it so much when it first happened. I think now, speaking to these people that I work with, I'm not like a first time person or first time medium that they've used. Like, they've explained to me certain people, and like they've used mediums for a while is what I will say, or people like what I can do, maybe not a medium, but someone who can tap into something to help them. Like I thought I was the first, and I didn't even think, you know, honestly, anything of it. And then now I'm like the 1,000th, like, you know what I mean? Like, they go through people, but they also test people. Like, they also, I don't want people to think that they just all of a sudden were like, just work with us, because that's not how it was. I had to prove myself like a lot. I had to prove myself to get to a good standing with these people. It wasn't like, oh, we trust Jimmy over here who says that, like, hey, like, you know, we're gonna do this. It's, they're like, we need to see what you can do, and we need to see the results of it, like if it's worth our time.
Let's talk about the other side for a second, basically the, sure. the charlatans. I could imagine how this gift obviously can give a lot of hope, and certainly when you're starting to describe things that no one else knows, you know, there's a real belief forged then. But you can also, you know, imagine that damage can be done if you're getting someone's trust and you're actually doing internet searches, and, you know, there's basically pursuing a financial element. Mm-hmm. What was the kind of perception? What was that other side in the environment where you started coming in?
Like with law enforcement or just people as like a general? Because
yeah, just in general, I think, you know, that medium psychic world, you know, who was doing your kind of profession, I guess, for lack of a better word, a disservice by their actions. It doesn't have to be names, but the types of people.
I think the types of people are obviously people that probably could research people, but from what I've seen, like actually like firsthand, like in a room, I guess, I call it cold reading or something. It's kind of like a cold call, right? But it's like, someone will go up to you and you essentially, like, without realizing, you're feeding them answers. Like, you're just feeding them answers. Like, they'll be like, there's a loved one with you who's a female, and it's like, you know, we've all lost a grandparent, right? We probably lost a grandma. Like, you know, people start plugging in stuff for certain people. So what I made it a pretty big point is for people not to say anything, just yes or no. Because it's like, you know, and I try to stay super far away from like the scheduling of sorts with it. Like, I just want people to either give me a fake name or just to give me your first name. Like, I don't care. Like that stuff doesn't care, because what's going to come through is going to come through, whether your name is really Jonathan or it's David, right? Like, it doesn't matter, I guess. But I have seen people do that. And because of that, I made it a pretty strong point to, like I said, to make sure like I can take all that stuff out, like the variables out of like people doubting. And there will be people that are doubting. But I always say to people, sit down with me for 10 to 15 minutes and let me change your mind. Because, you know, I have to say things that you can't Google, you can't search, you can't do that stuff. Because that's the important part of a reading. And that's also the important part of when you're working on a case. It's like, you can't know about the case. You can't Google the case. You can't have a bias. Like, you have to say things that you can't Google, that only the family member of the victim or someone, or like a detective that's on the case, they only know, because they were so close to it that no one else knows about it. So I try my best to make it as authentic for every single person as possible because of that, like types of like people that do that.
You mentioned about worrying that you had a mental illness when you were seeing what you were seeing. And obviously, you know, it's very intense for you specifically. But my wife has had moments where, I mean, like I lost my grandfather and we were all together in Portugal a few years ago. And she said she started smelling pipe smoke. She didn't know that my granddad's, you know, and it was out of the blue. It wasn't like she's always giving me readings from dead people. but she felt a presence. She felt like my gapper was there. And she's had a friend of mine's mother visit her. So just on occasion. And then she lost her boyfriend before me to suicide. And so, you know, she would get visits in her sleep, you know, from him as well. So I'm very open, obviously, to this interaction because I don't believe that you just exist in such a powerful way on the planet and then poof, you know, you're just atoms and that's it, you go away. So I'm definitely, you know, leaning into that. How many of us do you think have more of that and we realize and maybe we're turning it off because of, you know, this is quote unquote sensible not to talk that way?
So I always use this phrase for people. Everyone can sing, but not everyone can sing like Frank Sinatra, I always say. And the reason I say that is because everyone can do this. It's like everyone is open, but you are right, because when you're a child, you are so pure. Real life stuff hasn't really come into your life yet as far as like people being like, you know, mediums are weird, this is weird, do this, don't do that. So you're so pure and so open, like your funnel is probably like wide open. I always make that analogy. But then when like people start, you know, telling you stuff in that medium, you know, like so many different factors of life start to come into play, your funnel gets like a little bit closed, more closed. But with that being said, like I was saying, everyone can do this. Everyone has the ability. It's just what's the ability, right? Like some people always will talk about a gut feeling and then they'll be like, you know, I shouldn't go down this road today. And then they're like, holy crap. Like at that time, the road I was going to go on, there was a 10 car pileup where majority of the people passed away. And then there's people that are like having visits that are clairvoyant or mediums. And, you know, everyone has something. It's just trying to figure out what that is.
Beautiful. I'm glad I asked that question. Well, you talked about developing your skill. So what did that look like? How did you start, you know, doing the work, as it were, to get to the point where you could be an asset to a law enforcement agency?
Yeah. So I never thought I was even going to be. I thought they were just, you know, kind of blowing smoke, you know, up my butt or whatever. So basically how it started was I would see images, right? It's kind of like Pictionary, I would probably say. And you are learning your language. I always kind of like phrase it as you're learning a new language. So if you see a symbol, that means this. And then it starts to go faster and becomes more specific. And so as I was doing it, the symbols became kind of more, it's a silly analogy, it became from symbols to like screenshots in my head. And then it became like I'm seeing seven screenshots and it would tell a story. And the story was the person who's coming through, how they pass and things about them. And then it becomes the specifics. If they keep showing me my friend who has a scar on their cheek, I know that they had a scar on their cheek. And, you know, that's kind of how I was able to start working a little bit with law enforcement, is because when I was developing, they were seeing like a clear growth. And like I said, they were, you know, oh, I didn't even say this. They were sending people to me and testing me. And like, I didn't know that. I thought it was a friend of a friend. I had no idea. I thought it was just like a normal person that reached out to my mom who wanted a reading, but there was a rhyme of reason for everything. So as they saw me progressing throughout like a few years and they saw like the specifics of like kind of what I was giving them of like, there's a scar in the cheek, or there was this person there, and you know, certain things like that. That's when they knew my gift was developing enough to be able to be an asset for them. And I just want to make this so clear for everyone, because I think people watch movies, including myself, obviously. You know, I'm their last call. I'm really not their first. Like, I don't want people to think like when something happens, I'm their immediate like first call, because I'm not. They really exhaust all options before they go to me. Like, that's just the truth of it. And I'm okay like knowing that, and I'm okay with it. But that's really what it is. I'm their last option, not their first.
So you're not rolling up in the Bearcat fully tacked out, ready to make entry.
I'm not wearing my blues. I'm not wearing anything. I'm just going, you know, I'm sitting at my dinner table and I get a phone call and they're like, you have 15 minutes. Tell me what you got. Like that. Like,
it's, oh, wow.
Yeah. Cause they want, and I do get this now. Since I've been doing this like more, I kind of understand their process with it more so now. They don't want me to have a bias on anything, and they don't want me looking up anything. So they're like, let's call him and throw him off essentially and see truly authentically what he gets. And let's see if it stays the same throughout months time. Because like, I'm sure you know, and I'm sure a lot of your audience knows, like, you can't really solve a case. Typically, it's not a 1, 2, 3. And if you do, that is phenomenal. And like, God bless you, because that's amazing. But they have to do their stuff. And so they always try to throw me off, which is fine.
So what was the first case that you worked on? And then also kind of, you know, what is it that you start to see? Because as you touched on before, you know, you've got symbols and you've got screenshots and it's implying certain elements. But again, if we go to Hollywood, you know, Jonathan closes his eyes and he sees the guy digging the grave under the tree. Yeah. And he's like, that's where the body is.
I wish it was like that, but it's not. No, I wish. So my first case that I found out I was put on after through being tested, obviously, there was the Howard Beach jogger. And Howard Beach is like in Queens and in the New York area. And I was able to kind of tell them who to look into. I wasn't telling them that this is the person who did it. I don't give them information like that. I give them information where the honest truth of it is, I give them the information of, you're looking in the wrong direction, just go in this one, or you overlook this person, speak to this person. That's what it's like. That's what the person is showing to me. And it doesn't mean that they're the ones who did it. Typically, from what I'm learning, it means that they were either there or they have more additional information that they like went through everything with them. They like questioned them, they brought them in, and they're like, oh, they passed, like they're all good. Like, and I'm like, no, like you need to go back. And then all of a sudden they find out that they were there the night of the murder. They were there. Like, there's like a lot of different things. And I think people think kind of what you said with like the Hollywood thing. I close my eyes and it's like, dig here. This is where the bones are. Dig here. And it's really not like that. It's kind of like putting pieces together for them. I'm like such a small piece to a puzzle, because the amazing detectives like take what I say and they do their thing with it. And then they find that stuff out more than I do. It's just trying to keep a case open or trying to go in a different direction for them.
So with the Howard Beach jogger, what were they missing? And then what did they find when they circled around?
So the Howard Beach jogger was, this young woman was jogging and someone just brutally like murdered her, like on her jog. And they didn't know who did it. They had no idea. They like speculated people. There was a couple of things that they were speculating where it was either super random or it was like someone within the family, or like there's a couple theories that they were like, there was really 2 to 3 theories that they were pretty adamant on with it. You know, with it, like immediate family and then like some extended, like there was like 3 theories with it. So with me, when I got brought in, I was telling them just to speak to someone that they, like I said, that they thought was in the clear, essentially, right? Like they were like, we questioned them, they're all good. And they spoke to them and they were able to find some things with this person. Because I don't want to like name the people, because I just don't want to like, I still want to hold their respect with like the people that I work with. With that. So like, I don't want to be like, I said this and that's what I did. It's like, I just kind of told them what I saw, because they were sending me like, again, which I didn't know until after all this happened, family members of the young girl who was murdered. So they were sending me different family members, like cousins, you know, aunts, uncles, all these people, because they wanted to see if everything was consistent with what I was saying. Because if there was any inconsistency with what I was saying to each individual, then I wouldn't be an asset to them. Then I would be a problem.
So what about the Gabby Petito case?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, actually. So it actually originally started... I'm trying to think like the timeline, like the exact... It was like August, I think, of the year or something like that. I got reached out to and they were asking me, and it was just through a law enforcement person that I knew, just because I'm sure you know this and people do too. It happened in a multi-state like situation. So it wasn't just Utah or Wyoming or Florida. It was like a multi-state situation. And one of my contacts reached out to me and he was like, you know, what do you see? Because at this time she was missing. So he was like, do you think she's alive? Is this a search and rescue or a search and retrieval? Like, he's like, there's two different things. He's like, what do you see? And I told him, I said, if I'm connecting to her, like, it's the most unfortunate case of like what had happened. Cause I really can't connect to someone who's living. That's just not, you know, what I do. So at that point, he's like, okay, like, where do you see her? And I helped guide them to what I saw the landscape was of what she was trying to show me. It's not like, again, in the Hollywood, I'm like, go down this trail, make a right, and then go to this big tree with the oak and the red leaves. Like, I was kind of explaining to them what I was seeing from what she was providing to me. And they found her. And then at that point, Brian Laundrie was on the run. Right? Like at that point, he was on the run once all this happened. And then it became, help me find him, because we know he's still alive based on like certain things like that he was doing, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to take credit for that even slightly, because I think the law enforcement people did the absolute best job and they found him. I just told them what to expect when you do find him and where I saw it, and everything that I said checked out, and like kind of what I was guiding them, because I'm sure people can remember Gabby's case. He was on a manhunt for quite some time. It wasn't like a week. It wasn't like a few days. It was quite some time. So I was helping them guide them of like where I saw he was going, and it was all being recorded. And again, like finding out years later, you know, because you don't really find out in the moment of like anything during an active case. Like I just never will. I will always find out a year or two later. I guess they were listening to what I was saying, but also using their investigative skills too, and, you know, tracking certain things and all that, that, you know, some of the law enforcement people were like, does this kid have like a crystal ball or something? They're like, this is like super weird. Like, they're like, this is like super, super weird. And I just became friendly with a lot of other law enforcement by proving myself on that case, and also became very close with Gabby's mom during that, because I was helping them out.
Yeah, that was it Utah? Is that where that was?
Yeah, so the initial domestic situation was in Utah, but what actually, the killing took place in Wyoming.
Okay, and that was the one where he was out on the trails, and then he said initially that she gone missing?
Yeah, they said that they were like, you know, they were doing the YouTube backpacking like in a van thing. And they said they were parked at a place where all these other, you know, trucks or whatever were, or they were on a trail similar to where cars can park. And he said she just went missing. He really didn't like even say anything, because he called his parents and told them what happened and was using her credit card to like get gas and stuff when she was already dead. Like when they went back and they saw the timeline, they're like, she was already dead at that time when you were charging stuff to her card for gas to go back to Florida. So it originally started, like I said, in Utah, and then the horrible incident happened in Wyoming.
And they found him. He took his own life in the end. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With a letter and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's tragic. It really is.
Yeah.
Well, they're moving on to another big case, the Long Island serial killer. It's great that you have all these multiple cases. Now you start off going to law enforcement. They test you for a few years and now you're, you know, working on all these cases. So talk to me about that one.
Yeah, that was one of the first ones too. That was right after the Howard Beach one. So that case is, and I'm sure people can look it up at this point since now it's all like televised because they caught Rex. So basically, there was a task force, and one of the task force, the person who reached out to me was a similar situation where he heard from a friend of a friend of a friend through law enforcement, through the wife, through this. And they were like, what kind of what I said before, they're like, you have no like answers, you have no direction at this point. Like, you don't really know, like, what's the worst that can happen? Like, what's the worst that can happen? So coincidentally enough, I was actually sitting at this table where I'm at right now. He called me out of the blue, who's the lead FBI task force agent for this case. And he's now retired, but he called me and he did what now I'm kind of familiar with, which is, you have 15 minutes, tell me what you got. So I start talking about things because I think, yes, what Rex did is absolutely disgusting and horrible, but there's so many different elements to this case aside from the serial killer side. There's like corruption, like pretty evident on the, you know, there's just like a lot of corruption and stuff. So I was talking about that. And then I start talking about the unusual R sounding name, because I've, besides like the coach Rex Ryan, I never heard of the name Rex. Besides like me thinking about maybe a dinosaur, which I know is stupid, because trust me, I know it sounds stupid, but that's kind of how it was. And I'll never forget, he chuckled and laughed and he goes, all right, and hangs up the phone. That's literally what I got. And my parents are like, what the heck was that? Because they were sitting at the other end of the table. It was like that random at dinner. And I was like, I don't even know. Like, I was like, I don't know what the case is. Like, I don't even know. So fast forward like a year or so, I hear that the task force gets closed, like for corruption's side of things. So they're like, we're done with this case for now. And then years go by and then a new DA comes in the area and reopens the case. Like, that's literally like kind of how it happened. They were investigating for so long. They were getting, you know, every obstacle that was thrown their way was because of a reason. And then they're like, all right, you know, and they closed the case because they weren't able to progress anything forward. There was like nothing really going forward that they could show clear evidence on. And then the corruption side like started to become more exposed. And then the new DA came in and reopened it. And then a year or two later, they listened to what I said and some of the stuff like I was saying, like, you know, not too long ago, you know, about it, because I would get reached out to by detectives that are on the second task force, and they were reaching out to me. And I'll never forget this too. It was in July, I think. I get a text from the first lead task force FBI agent. He wrote, "Great day for our task force." And I wake up. And all of a sudden it's boom, Rex is caught. Boom, the Long Island serial killer is caught. And then my phone's blowing up from all these people. And, you know, and it was crazy. It's crazy and it's still ongoing. There's still a lot more that's going to come out. And, you know, it's a little nuts. I'm not going to lie. To be a part of something like that, I have to be honest, was nuts. And to still get inside information, like as far as like what's going on in the investigation, what they've learned. And sometimes they'll call to, you know, hear my opinion, like with like, and by opinion, I mean readings and stuff. It's weird, man. I have to be honest. It's weird.
When you talk about corruption, was that in the law enforcement judicial side or was it another area?
Yeah, it was the law enforcement judicial side. Yeah.
I've had people on the show who have been victims of that. They ended up in prison. You know, one was accused of being a sex offender, and he was a completely innocent 18-year-old high school football player that happened to be staying with a friend who was actually the predator. And they never even looked at this kid, the one who did it. So while Greg was in prison, this other guy ended up raping another girl.
My God.
You know, and then I've had another one that was in prison for 19 years guy. And he was in Las Vegas when there was a robbery in Orange County, California. And there was eyewitnesses and everything. So it's important to kind of highlight when there is corruption, because, you know, it destroys lives of people who are falsely accused. Or if a killer continues to be free, we lose more people.
And that's why when the new DA came in, he was like, no more of this. And I give him all of the credit, because he came in with a no BS. Like, he's like, I don't care who this is going to hurt, like in the sense of like, you've been protected for so long, so now it's going to hurt you. He's like, I don't really care. And I give him all of the credit. And people can look him up. It's Suffolk County DA guy. You guys can look him up on Long Island. His name's Ray. He's absolutely amazing. Like, he's amazing with what he did and how he put an end to it. Because he did. He literally came in and he was like, you know, I'm going to do this and whatever happens, happens. And he's like, there needs to be like a law and order type of thing. Like, there can't be people protecting people to hurt other people just because you're law enforcement. So I really respect him. Like, I actually very much respect him a lot.
Absolutely. That's what we need. It's 100% yeah. What we need. Before we progress on, are there any other notable cases that maybe I haven't mentioned up to this point?
I wouldn't say notable, like the notable ones that are like Gabby and Long Island serial killer cases. There are a lot of the cases that I've been working on recently and like now are cases that, listen, there's cases that happen all the time, but there's also cases that don't break past local news, wherever that they're from, and they just don't have the resources to really like investigate fully. So I've been helping out with like certain like departments and, you know, like small towns. Wait, I take that back. There is a case to, actually, I'm sorry.
Go for it.
I'm sorry. I'm like, I don't think so. There's Richard Petrone and Daniel Imbo. It's a big case in Philly. It's a 20-year unsolved and the FBI like couldn't crack it. And it's like so weird how this one happened. I got reached out to because they were doing a show on it, right? Like, they were like, it's a 20th anniversary. We know your involvement with law enforcement. We fact checked, blah, blah, blah. Let's see what you got. Like, let's see if you can do anything. And supposedly, from what I was told, they took my reading and they're investigating some of the stuff in my reading. Like, because they're like, wait a minute, this checks out to this, which checks out to this. And like, we never really dove fully like into that. So I was told that, you know, the FBI in Philly have been using it, and I'm not sure the status of it, to be honest, but that's just a case that recently just happened. Like, I recently just found out about that. They're using what I said to, you know, further along a case.
Brilliant. Well, that's obviously the kind of, you know, crime law enforcement side. Talk to me about the regular people and even, you know, the first responder military, because I saw on the website, obviously, you talk about closure.
Yep.
For example, my beautiful wife, you know, that, you know, her and then his family members and all his friends, you know, when someone takes their own life, they're left with this sense of, you know, why didn't we see it? And there's a lot of guilt. And, you know, I've really unpacked so many elements of issues that lead to a mental health crisis, for example. And, you know, that at that point, the brain isn't working the way it's supposed to be working, you know, so you can't make sense of what happened, because if you've got a healthy brain trying to understand an unhealthy brain, you're not going to be able to connect the two. And so emotionally, that leaves people, you know, with guilt, with shame, whatever the negative emotions are. So talk to me about just being able to bring some closure, whether it's with regular civilians or even in my community.
Yeah, I mean, I don't take that lightly, is what I tell people, because it's the truth. Like, they're coming to you for answers, and, you know, it's tough to say, but a lot of people are broken, I think, when it comes to that, because you're right. Like, they're sometimes people can't see it coming. Most of the time people don't. And they're left with why, what happened, and just things like that. So anytime I get a lot of military, and a lot of the military people that I get, I don't want to sound like, you know, their friends in the military take their own lives because of various different reasons. Maybe the resources when they came back weren't the greatest. And I think sometimes doctors throw antidepressants at people at times and or whatever it is. So when I go into a reading, my first and foremost thing is to always try to give them closure in the sense of like, I know how serious this is and I don't want to take it lightly. So I want to go into it softly. I'll never be like, this person's here and this is what I see and it's intense. Because if I was sitting on the other end, I would be like, why the hell did you just say it like that? Like show some like empathy. So I don't take it lightly. And a lot of people come, like I said, and they're broken and they just need something. So I give everyone, no matter who it is, everything I got. I will never just go into a reading and just be like, all right, like it's this amount of time. Like, let's just, you know, coast it in. Like people know, like I'm drenched in sweat after, like, you know, I can only do so much after it. There's physical side effects of it for me. And with this, when I push myself the way that I do with this, but I never take it lightly because I want to make sure someone leaves with some type of closure. Do I think I'm going to provide the full closure for people? Probably not, you know, probably not. But if I can help them take a step forward in that journey, then that's a win. You know, if they're stuck and they can't take a step forward and I help them take their first step, just in general, after the reading, they're like, wow, like this helped. I think I won, you know, like in this sense, like it's the most rewarding feeling to me. Cause like I'm a realist and I know majority of the time coming to me, like you're not going to get the full closure. That's just not realistic in life. That's just not. So I try to go into everything very softly.
This would be an interesting perspective. As I've progressed, as I've matured and learned from so many of these incredible people I have on the show, a lot of them have very powerful mental health stories of their own. Some are more in the kind of clinical setting. But you start to realize that, as I said, the brain becomes miswired. It becomes, you know, it's broken in a very, very compassionate way. So you think about all the contributing elements, you know, what happened in your childhood if it was left unaddressed, sleep deprivation, organizational betrayal, the side effects of meds, social media, you know, I mean, all the different, you know, elements that cause the perfect storm in some people's minds. I grew up in a generation where suicide was viewed as selfish and cowardly and how could you and think of your kids. But then when you actually hear from people who have been there, some who even went through with their attempt and they survived, you hear that at that point, their entire reality is distorted and they believe that they were the reason for their family's pain. So the guilt and shame just even amplifies then. So you take someone in the military and law enforcement and fire who has already sworn to die for a complete stranger if it comes to it. And then you get this deep belief that they are now the problem. One could argue that suicide becomes selfless and, you know, a very courageous act. Now, it's not saying that's what people should be doing, but in that moment, it's not cowardly and selfish. That person truly believes that they're doing the right thing for their family, even though, as I said, a healthy brain, it doesn't make any sense. Did you get a sense of that element of that person not wanting to escape their family, but also almost like a sense of doing the right thing, even though in this actual world, you know, when you're not in a mental crisis, that, you know, obviously is the opposite of what happens.
Yeah, I would say in some cases, yes. I will say definitely that, you know, they felt like there was nothing, like there's a couple of things, because there's a lot of different situations. I've seen where they felt like the family would be better off without them. Like, you know, like they fully believe that. They fully believe that they caused issues, trouble, that they're, you know, a failure, whatever the case is, because that does come through where they share their thoughts with me before they took their own life. And because I need to get the specifics and an understanding. But what I've also saw is that, you know, you are right. They thought it was a selfless act, you know, because they they felt like they, it was like constant ups and downs and disappointment and just tearing people left and right. And they were the cause of it. And they know that they were the cause of it, whether that's the case or not. In their mind, they thought that they were ripping people apart. And I have to be honest, in most scenarios that, like, when I speak to the parents or whoever of a child that like did this, like they thought everything was good. Like they didn't even know, like they had no idea. They thought at times maybe he or she was like a little like to themselves, but they thought they're a teenager. Like that's what they want. They want their alone time. They don't want to be with mom and dad or whoever. But speaking to parents and doing this, whether it's parents, brother, sister, and uncle, it really doesn't matter. It all comes down to the same thing where they all thought this was the right move for them to do. Like they thought that this was the right thing to help the family. They thought it was the right thing because they just couldn't live anymore based on like their perception was not reality. Like their perception of the world was not like reality, but to them it was. So sometimes when I do these readings and stuff, and in those cases of people taking their own lives and everything, it's because I've lost a lot of people to suicide. Like I lost a lot. And I always think I'm like, I never saw it coming. Like I just didn't see one of my closest friends doing this. I just didn't. Like, and then another one. And then another one. And then I'm starting to find out kind of what you're saying. It's like sometimes they don't address things because they felt like they were embarrassed or they didn't have the resources, whatever the case is, but they never asked, right? It's like the parents, when I read them or whatever, will be like, they never asked. Like, and it's so tough to be in that position to like deliver that message to those families, being like, this is why, from what I see. And then they validate it by giving me examples of what was left behind and, you know, looking back. And yeah, it's, I've realized that they feel like their brain was wired to the point where they felt this was the only option for them. And they were doing their family such a service. Like they were doing them such a service of removing themselves from a picture of like life. And it's like kind of hard for me to wrap my head around at times, even when I'm doing readings or even speaking about it to people. Like it is hard because it's because they come back, and when they come through, you know, they come through as them, as their best selves, right? Healthy, happy. They come through as their best selves. And but then they bring me back to how they were. So it's like I see two versions of people of like that, like pretty quickly. I see their best version and then their worst version. So it's just tough to go through a reading like that with people, but it's my job because I want to help people in that way.
It's such a powerful perspective to hear it, obviously from a set of eyes, a lens that none of us would have ever heard this before, but it aligns. And I've just got this Venn diagram now with this podcast and hundreds, I'm almost at 1,000 episodes now. You know, those lines intersect and that truth really kind of radiates. And I think what is, you know, what we can glean from these, you know, hearing these stories is just simply if you are starting to feel like you're a burden, that is a huge red flag. That is your sign to go and get help. Not when you're sitting there with a pistol and a bottle of whiskey. You know, that whole call me if you're struggling, that isn't going to land with that person at that point. But yeah, when you believe that you're a piece of shit, that you're the reason, you know, that, you know, your kids are scared of you, all this stuff, which I hear over and over again in uniform, that, you know, that's the red flag. But also that post-traumatic growth, you know, that best version of that person, that could have been them, you know, if the stars had aligned and they'd actually been able to get the help that they needed. I truly believe that that person struggling can then navigate through and become an even more resilient version of themselves. So that puts hope into doing the work. But you can't get someone through that crucible if you don't know they're hurting. And I think, you know, going back to what you said with your parents, so many of us are just, you know, drowning in work. My profession, you know, they're understaffed, so they're getting, you know, the hours are already insane, then they're getting told they have to stay extra shifts, And so it's easy then for the people that are struggling to fall between the cracks, whether it's those in uniform, maybe it's the family members of those in uniform.
Yeah, because I'm also seeing it too with all my close friends that are still active on the job. It is extremely understaffed. Like they're working their tour times and then they get pulled into overtime and they get pulled in for another 6 to 8 hours of like, you know, work when they're supposed to have days off. And then they, you know, a lot of my friends become zombies. They just do. And they forget to put themselves like first, right? Like they forget to take care of themselves mentally, physically, anything that kind of like can be an outlet for them. And I see it all the time. Like I see it all the time. Like anytime I'm supposed to meet up with a couple of my friends that are still active, I get a text like, hey, I got pulled in, you know, I got compact, you know, overtime, I got this, I got that. And I'm like, wow, like you really have like little to no time off any, like it's like, and I see when they do come and like have a drink with me or whatever, right? Like they're zombies. And I tell them, I'm like, go home and sleep. And like, because I try to explain to them, I'm like, if you're not sharp, just in general, like, you know, you're going to, it's going to affect you mentally when you're not even realizing it's affecting you mentally. Like you're just going to be sad. You're going to be depressed. And I've seen it happen so many times, like so many times with my friends that are on the job. And I'm trying to be an advocate for them in the sense of like, I check in on them all the time, all my close friends that are on the job. I just want to make sure that they're, you know, doing okay. Like if they ever want to talk to me, they ever want to sit down with me, I'm like, let's just grab a drink or let's grab a bite to eat. Let's go like work out together, like whatever, right? Like anything that they can do just to vent, I'm trying to be that person for them because it's tough.
Absolutely. Well, especially another element that I've discovered is, you know, extremely crushing is that organizational betrayal. And so if you're in a city and obviously NYPD, you know, we see the videos of all these little assholes riding on the police cars, you know, standing on and, you know, beating up cops and, you know, their hands being tied as far as who they can or can't arrest anymore. And that's another compounding element. So, you know, you've got this recruitment crisis, you're putting it on the shoulders of the men and women who are still holding the line. And then you're not backing them up when they need to, you know, use force or enforce, you know, when a crime is happening, who cares if it was only $800, it's still a crime. So, you know, you got all these compounding parts, which then again, if you think about an ancient tribal mentality, it's like the tribe that you've been a part of, that you swore to possibly die for, has now turned your back, then back on you. So that, you know, emotionally can be crushing as well.
Yeah, like I also know like all my friends are like literally exactly what you just said. Their hands are tied. They're afraid to do their job properly. Like they really are. Like they're afraid to go through procedural things where 10 years ago, I don't know if that would have been the same thing. And you know, it's crazy about the recruitment stuff that you're talking about and like trying to get people on the job because I'm not gonna name any names, obviously, but you know, I've heard stories where people, you know, got fired from like corrections or whatever, right? They were on a different civil service job and got fired. And, you know, they're struggling. So they let them go through the process. They just did. And it's like, you know, they need people and it's tough. It's tough. It's a tough time. A lot of people that I know that are going through the process now or, you know, want to be a police officer, I tell them like, you know, listen, it's one of the best things you can do. I'm like, trust me, but I'm like, you just have to be like on, you know, like head on a swivel, like times 10, like it's a times 10 now. It's not like head on a swivel, like kind of like know your surroundings. I'm like, it's a times 10 because I'm like, you're viewed as, which is kind of crazy, like public enemy number one, even though like they're the first people to call you when something happens. I'm like, you're still viewed as public enemy number one. So I'm like, you always have to protect yourself and head on a swivel times 10. I always like for like these new recruits that I see at the gym and stuff that come up to me and ask me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we need to, you know, if there's not going to be a support, there's not going to be a police force anymore. People got to understand that. And I've talked about this a lot. When you lower standards, you're just increasing the chance of a mistake being made in your department. If you hold standards high and you support your men and women in uniform, then I wouldn't argue. We know this is the case. When the standards are high and working environments are improved, you'll have people lining up around the building to test for you again. But lowering standards and not fixing the things that are broken is just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, like I remember when I was going through the process, you had to be at the, you know, like, I don't want to say the building, but you had to be at the building, you know, clean shaved, in a suit, everything filled out by 6 a.m. So if you're not there by 6 a.m., I remember they were throwing people out. I remember people would come without a tie. They were thrown out. You weren't standing in formation correctly, even in a suit, thrown out. Like, I just remember that. Like, I remember going through that and like calling my mom and being like, wow, like a kid like came from Long Island and his train was delayed and he showed up at 6:15 and they still threw him out. Like, they still threw him out and they made him like, you know, come back another day, but was like trying to prove a point, I think, to everyone. But I just remember going through the process and seeing that and being like, oh my God, like if I didn't come an hour before in line with paperwork, clean shave, suit, tied, everything pressed, I was petrified to like not do that. And now my, you know, I see people come in with beards. I see people come in without, you know, just like it's a little different.
Absolutely. Well, moving away from that topic to you, you know, as far as the medium side, you talked about some of these readings, you know, you're dripping with sweat. You hear this a lot from mental health counselors. I mean, I've even observed it just doing this podcast. Some of the people that come on the show, it's an extremely emotional journey that, you know, I'm listening to and sharing with them. And if you're not careful, it does take a toll. So how do you offset that? How do you kind of, you know, repair, rest, recover from some of these readings?
You know, I have to rely heavily on my family and my new wife. And, you know, going outside, going for runs, working out, staying active, you know, because if I sit with my thoughts after it, you know, just like in anything that's heavy, it's like, you don't want to bring work home, even though like majority of the time people do. You know, I try just to rely on my family and, like I said, my wife, and being active, being normal, running, volleyball, surfing, snowboarding, everything.
You mentioned your wife. I saw an article just from a few weeks ago when you got married, and obviously they did the piece on that. So talk to me about being Jonathan Mark, the medium, but trying to date, so having some anonymity, but then having to ultimately reveal to your girlfriend that you are actually a medium.
Yeah, no. I, you know, in previous relationships before, that's when I start going out to Los Angeles for like a little bit. And I was like, you know, reading public figures and, you know, doing stuff. And I could see sometimes, and just in past relationships and stuff, it doesn't really matter who it was. I saw them wanting to go to Los Angeles with me, meeting people, like being in like rooms and stuff. And I kind of got to a point where I'm like, I'm just not going to say anything, right? Like, we're just going to talk. And if she asks what I do, I'm just going to say, like an entrepreneur, like, you know, just things like that, make it vague until I, feel like there's a real connection and there's a real future. So with now my wife, Jess, she would hear like FBI calling me, the DA's calling me, like she heard all the calls. So she thought I was working with law enforcement, but she wasn't sure what I was doing for them because she would hear the calls. I'd be with her and those calls would just randomly come and I would have to take them. I couldn't not take them. So I never corrected her. I just like kind of just was like, yeah, I work with law enforcement. I'm like, I help them with unsolved or something. And she's like, okay. And then I was going to LA and I was, you know, I was like, do you want to come? And she's like, yeah. So I had to tell her, being like, this is like not like a trip for a vacation. This is like a work thing for me where I'm, you know, having meetings and things like that. So I told her, And she had no idea what a medium was. Like, so she said, prove it. Like, that was her New York thing. Prove it. Like, and I pulled in someone that she's never spoken about, her family doesn't speak about, because kind of, I think what you mentioned before about taking someone's own life, and like some people, like, cause she's Colombian, like half Colombian, and with like religion and just how people view stuff with like, you know, taking your own life, like her family just doesn't talk about it. Like, they say that this person died from natural causes. Like, that's what the family says, because they don't want people to know. So I said the specifics of how it was done, what happened, and she like stared at me and started crying. And she's like, I don't understand how you know that, because like, worst case scenario, kind of what you brought up, even if I was to Google it, it says from natural causes, I'm sure, because that's what everyone says in her family still. So once that happened, you know, she was crying, and like, we were watching TV and she was just staring at me like, what the hell just happened? And, you know, from there, she became my biggest supporter. And then I kind of opened up like what my life in the medium space was. And then, you know, she just became my biggest supporter. Now she is obviously my biggest supporter. She's my wife and, you know, my best friend. And, you know, I accredit a lot to her, because she brings me back down to grounds, you know, to ground zero, kind of, when I'm either, you know, not in a good place or anything. Like, she'll bring me back down to that level where I need to, like, you know, take a deep breath. And now that she knows who, I guess, Jonathan Mark is at that time, and then kind of now, you know, she's just been pretty awesome about it.
Was it online dating that you met each other?
Yeah. So it was during COVID. It was an app called Bumble. And the app is like, the girl has to reach out to the guy first, for people who don't know. And all she wrote was, hey. Like, it wasn't anything crazy, right? She just wrote, hey. And we were talking. And then this was during the time in COVID. And I don't know if people like blacked it or blocked it out. But this was the time during COVID where you go to a restaurant or a bar, but you had to, there was like the plexiglass stuff to separate you. But in order for you to sit down at a table, you had to order food. And then there's a curfew at like 11:30 at night. So like, there was like all these rules in place. And that's when we first met, was during that. So we had a curfew at the bar. And we had, you know, we had to get dinner. Like, it was like a little bit of an interesting thing, because they would give us like popcorn and chips to be like your food when you ordered a drink, but you had to sit down. You couldn't like stand up at the bar, like, and just like chat and like whatever. So it was a really interesting time. Like, we really got to know each other like really well because of that. Like, we had no other option.
There's nothing that kills romance like rubber gloves and perspex.
Yeah, literally. And being like, all right, you have to be out of the bar at 11:30. Like, and we're like, what? We just got here 2 hours ago. Like, it was crazy.
Yeah, I met my wife on Match.com. This okay. was 12 years ago now. But yeah, I mean, there's some stigma around that. But it's a great way of, you know, trying to narrow down a group of people and then find someone who seems to match. And it's funny because we've been talking about this kind of sensitivity in the medium element. Whatever you call it, this bloody woman is my soulmate, because we joke with each other. Like, if I'm thinking something, she knows exactly what I'm thinking, and vice versa. So neither of us would ever be able to be unfaithful, because we'd know about it straight away. So she can't fake an orgasm, any of that stuff.
Yeah.
I would know.
Yeah. I think same with Jess too. Jess, like she would not be able, like, I would know if something bad like that happened, and vice versa. We just, like, I haven't found someone ever, like, obviously I married her, but, you know, it's, I can't even really explain it. Like, it's just the best thing. Like, I don't have to say anything. She knows what I'm like feeling, thinking. Like, I literally don't have to say anything. And same with her. I can tell by facial expression, a face movement, same with her. Like, you know, it's, I love it.
Well, speaking of that, one last question before we go to some closing questions.
Sure.
You mentioned about us having, you know, so much more kind of ability to tap into this when we're younger. And I can literally remember being so much more, you know, tuned in, and sometimes in a bad way. I had night terrors. And so there was a lot of kind of the other side, you know, that I had to deal with as a child as well. But as we get older, and certainly, you know, all the things that you mentioned with your men and women in NYPD, just the kind of beat down, you know, we get further and further and further away from that. What are some of the tools that people can use to just simply try and tap back into that thing that seemed innate when we were a child?
That's a really good question. It's going to sound, trust me, it's going to sound so basic, and it's going to sound like kind of like a no shit, I think people are going to be like, but meditating is the best thing. And I'll tell you why. Because when you do readings in general, if I go into a reading, like a client reading, not even like an unsolved, just like a normal client reading, but maybe I'm, you know, having issues with Jess, like worst case scenario, the reading will be heavily geared towards relationship stuff, whether it's with her loved ones or et cetera, because that's still in the back of my mind. So in order to be able to connect to people and to reopen that, to be able to connect to loved ones, friends, whoever, the moment you're able to get into a meditative state to blank your mind out, like there's no thoughts going on, you can't have any thoughts, that's when the messages and that's when the stuff starts to happen. And I also tell people too, you know, when you're just waking up or just falling asleep and you feel like you saw something, then all of a sudden you like wake up, you become like wired because it startles you. That's a visit. The most times people will get visits, it's when they're kind of falling asleep, they're super tired or just waking up. But in order to like kind of control that and to like tap in, like again, it's going to sound stupid, my advice is to learn how to truly blank your mind out and meditate. That's like my advice, only because it works. And I've seen it work with like, you know, myself and other like people that are close to me. Cause I don't even like train mediums. Like I don't even know how I would even do that because I don't even know how the hell I do this. So it's like, but I do know when you blank out your mind, they're able to put that stuff in your head. Like they're able to put something in your head.
I thought you were probably going to say that when I asked it, and I'm so glad that was the answer. When you look at the mental health conversation, you know, more often than not, meditation is a very powerful tool for us. And it's just that busyness. Anxiety is that those intrusive thoughts. Depression is kind of, you know, past intrusive thoughts. But what's interesting is you can have the same exact conversation, especially with people that maybe think that that's all woo-woo, when it comes to performance. Okay, well then forget about your mental health for a second. Do you want to be the best, you know, tactical operator or, you know, firefighter, whatever it is, the clearest mind when you're searching for that child in that building? Well, then meditation is the answer again. What's really exciting is I recently had a guy called Jim Poole on the show, who is the CEO of NuCalm, N-U-C-A-L-M. And that is a passive, it's an app now. It used to be a big machine. And you basically put on a blindfold or a sleep mask, excuse me, and earphones. And it's the undulations. And the backstory is basically a very, very intelligent scientist figured out the frequency the brain is at certain states and then figured out how to put the brain into certain states. And I can tell you hands down, it's not snake oil. It works amazingly. But I've had numerous people now, someone just the other day, who when they do NuCalm, their meditation goes even deeper. So you add that tool in as well, which is, like I said, an app. And then you have meditation. Now you've amplified that and got to an even deeper state and an even calmer mind.
Oh, wow. I need to try that out for me. Honestly, I'm going to download it. Honestly.
It's amazing. Yeah. It really is. Yeah. I mean, you'll feel it as passive. So even if you've got a busy mind that day, you'll just, you know, you'll be thinking all of a sudden, you know, you just kind of drop and it's almost like you got one foot in sleep, one foot in wakefulness, and you're kind of dancing around it. And then the time of the session, you know, it doesn't feel like it was 20 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever it is. But it's, you know, you get this kind of feeling of you've done like a full sleep cycle. But yeah, it just takes everything down. It down regulates. So it's an amazing. And then you couple that with Headspace or, you know, whatever the meditation is that you do, you know, the same day or, you know, the next day, whatever it is. Yeah, it's those two together are incredible.
That's awesome. That's very cool.
Brilliant. All right. Well, then the first of the closing questions, is there a book or are there books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
It's probably completely unrelated, honestly. I think it goes back to like the military stuff. I read a lot of like military books, like people that have served. I actually have a couple on my phone that I still have that because I read them on my phone, which is also very silly. And trust me, I know I'm going to pull them up. So the one that I read recently was The Red Circle by Brandon Webb. That's a book that I really, really like. And I read Lone Survivor, American Sniper, you know, those types of books, because I want to hear the real stories of everything. So those are the books that I typically read. And I'm sure your fan base probably listens to them or reads them too. But I don't really read anything in the spiritual thing. Like, I know that sounds silly, but I'm very fascinated by military.
What about films and documentaries?
Okay, so this is going to sound silly, so trust me. I know I keep saying that, but when I tell people, they like look at me like I have 10 heads. Because I work a lot on the unsolved stuff, I don't really watch too much because I feel like now a lot of what's on TV and the documentaries and stuff are a bunch of unsolved cases. And I'm like, I need to like get away from that. Like I can't. So I watch like, you know, I just started watching The Rookie because I'm very close with two of the actors on there. I started watching Shrinking, the show with Jason Segel. Yeah, I watch like those comedy shows, I think, just because I try to get away from the documentaries and stuff.
Beautiful. Well, speaking of amazing people, is there a person that you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Oh, yeah, I have two. I mean, I'm sure people probably may have said the same. Sean Ryan. I think he's very fascinating, and I think he's, you know, great and brilliant. And Nick Irving too. I think those two would be awesome.
I need to get Nick on. We went back and forth a long time ago, and he was going to come on, and then it kind of petered out. So I need to circle around him because he's a Green Beret author now, isn't he? Yeah. And then Sean is funny. His name's come up a lot recently, and I've wanted to get him on for a while now. So I got to start, you know, really pooling my Navy SEAL resources to see if I can find a mutual friend.
Absolutely. I mean, he's just super intelligent, and you know, similar to you, you guys are really smart, and you're both really trying to help this community, and it's pretty awesome. And I think it would just be such great synergy between the two of you. That's why, like, immediately, that's why I didn't want you to be like, you know, everyone says this, but there is a rhyme or reason. You're both very smart and great synergy, I would assume. And also you're both, like I said, helping such an important community that isn't spoken about a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm hoping we'll make it happen. I'll definitely let you know.
Fingers crossed, man.
All right. Well, we talked about how you decompress already, which is normally my next question. So
yeah.
Before we go to where people can find you, do you want to give a kind of teaser about the show, or is that still under wraps at the moment?
Yeah. So it's really just my season two of my podcast. That's like, you know, the big thing right now. And it's called Connect with Jonathan Mark. And the first season, the first like 10 episodes were celebrities and stuff, which is great. But then I started working, you know, I brought Gabby Petito's mom on. That's with the Richard Petrone and Daniel Imbo stuff came in, like, cause that team came on mine. And this next season, which we started to recording, are a bunch of unsolved cases, some that are absolutely huge, like they made movies on and stuff with the family members and detectives. And then there's some, like I said, that haven't broken past local news. And I want to give them a platform to maybe have someone speak up or bring attention to it. And I want to help the family and closure and to give them answers. So this season coming up will be a lot of unsolved, and there will be some celebrities that pop in, but it's going to be predominantly helping families with unsolved cases.
Beautiful. So where are the best places then for people to find you, you know, as a medium, find the podcast and any other areas?
So the podcast is, you know, on wherever you get your podcast. So Spotify, Apple, and my Instagram, you know, is Jonathan Mark Medium, and it has my website on there and an email button. If you are interested in a reading, you can 100% reach out whenever anyone is ready. No, like no pressure to anyone.
Beautiful. Well, Jonathan, I want to say thank you so much. It's been such an interesting conversation, very, you know, outside the box, as it were, but so much synergy. Again, this is what happens, you know, the when you explore outside your own kind of echo chamber, you know, you start seeing so many parallels, so many intersections. So I want to thank you so, so much for being so generous with your time today and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been amazing. And I recommend to anyone who's listening to come on if you have the opportunity.